Hi, I'm Michael Senoff, founder and CEO of HardToFindSeminars.com. For the last 5 years, I've interviewed the world's best business and marketing minds. Along the way, I've created a successful publishing business all from home from my two-car garage. When my first child was born, he was very sick, and it was then that I knew I had to have a business that I could operate from home. Now my challenge is to build the world's largest free resource for online downloadable MP3 audio business interviews. I knew I needed a site that contained strategies, solutions, and inside angles to help you live better, to save and make more money, to stay healthier, and to get more out of life. I've learned a lot in the last 5 years, and today I'm going to show you the skills you need to survive. Setting up these entities is kind of like offense and defense in a football game.
Absolutely. It goes back to my favorite motto, control everything, enjoy everything, but own nothing.
Hi, this is Michael Senoff with HardToFindSeminars.com. Get ready, because in the next 90 minutes, you're going to hear one of the most detailed explanations of asset protection that I've ever heard. I had the privilege of meeting a gentleman named Gary C. Gary is an expert in asset protection. He will show you how to legally safeguard your wealth, property from lawsuits, creditors, bankruptcy, probate, and other financial disasters that can unexpectedly wipe you out. So get ready, take lots of notes, and this is the kind of interview you're going to want to hear more than once. Check the transcripts and let's get going. Enjoy. What's your expertise in financial planning and business structure that I want to pick your brain on? Because after talking to you earlier, I mean, you sound like an absolute genius. I want to ask you a lot about this stuff, so hopefully in the next couple hours, I can pick your brain and learn as much as I can. I think everyone knows how important this is, but it's almost like when you're selling a preventative, people don't want to really think about these terrible things that can happen. But certainly they do, and the proper planning ahead of time, it's so important. What would you tell someone that doesn't want to face the reality how important this is? If you were to try and convince someone how important this is to properly plan this stuff and how you could solve this problem for them by doing all the hard work, I mean, is it going to be a pain in the butt for someone getting this set up, or is that what a professional financial planner, like with all your designations, does? Do you make it an easy process?
It is not necessarily an easy process to get it done. It just takes money and some time and the proper structures and the proper documents. But the biggest problem I have with people is to get them to stop and think. I don't try to teach people a lesson or scare them. I just try to rattle the birdcage a little bit so they'll change their paradigm. But just remember that my motto is enjoy everything, own nothing. Let's imagine that we're looking at a castle in the middle of a moat. It has two drawbridges. One is an entrance and one is an exit. And for some reason, someone puts all of their wealth inside of this castle, but they forget and leave the drawbridges down. So now anyone can come in, the IRS, plaintiffs, lawsuits, divorce, and steal all that cash and run out the other door, can't they?
Right. We got a drawbridge on each side of the castle.
Right. So what we need to do is pull up those drawbridges where anyone who's trying to attack or obtain our wealth can only sit on the bank of the moat and fish and hope that they catch something.
It's a great analogy.
That is the best fortress that you can ever have. And the way you create a financial fortress, Michael, is you separate your liabilities from your wealth. There is no law that says that you have to be totally liable for everything you own. For example, I like to set up a domestic trust that holds all of my wealth, my brokerage accounts, my investments, things of that nature, in one entity. And then my automobiles are held in another entity. And the reason for that is, if I go out and own everything and I have a car wreck, do you think that $100,000 is going to satisfy that plaintiff if I happen to kill the driver of the other car?
No.
No, the insurance is not going to cover it. What are they going to do? They're going to come after everything that I own. However, if an entity owns that car, well, let me put it this way. You walk into an attorney's office and you tell him a sad story, and it may be a true story, and you say, this guy hurt me, and I want you to sue him, and I don't have the money to pay you, but I need you to take it on a contingency. because this guy owns a business, and I know he's got money. And so the judge thinks, we got a good target here. And so what's the first thing an attorney does? He says, well, let me investigate this for a few days, and I'll call you back. So what he does, he gets his investigator to go out, and in about 72 hours, he'll know everything that you own or have a connection to. Now, if that investigator comes back and says, man, this guy, he owns four or five companies, he's got this, he's got that, we got a good prospect for a lawsuit here, then the attorney's going to probably take the case on. But on the other hand, if his investigator comes back and says, you know that guy that hit that other guy in the car accident? He doesn't own anything. He doesn't own a car. He doesn't own a house. He has no assets. Then the attorney's got two choices. First choice is probably what's going to happen. He's going to drop the case against you right then and there because it's just not worth his time. Or the other thing is he's going to get some money up front or ask for a larger contingency. And that generally will stop the lawsuit there in his tracks. So it's an asset protection move.
In our courts today, civil lawsuits are about one thing, money.
That's all they're about.
If there's no money, there's usually no civil lawsuit.
Well, if you can get $2 million for being stupid and spilling a cup of coffee on your lap, come on. You know, there's about 1 million attorneys in the United States now, and another 800,000 are going to graduate in the next 3 years. What are all these people going to do for a living? They're going to have to sue somebody to earn some fees. So predatory litigation is sadly the modus operandi. And so we have to protect ourselves against it. And people that don't think that they can have a lawsuit or don't think no one will sue them are sadly mistaken.
Do you know some stats on that off the top of your head?
There's over 600,000 lawsuits filed each year, basically for monetary and mental damage.
600,000?
600,000. The average doctor in a career of 10 years gets sued 3 times. So those are statistics.
Do you know some stories where they lose it all?
Yes, I do know stories where they lose it all, but most of my professional clients have never lost a dime. They had to pay off their malpractice insurances, but they haven't lost any personal wealth because they really don't own it. Let me ask you a question. Is what you see really what you see? Is it real or is it an illusion? Is there a different way to think about this? Is it possible, just barely possible, that you could ever be sued? If you understand that what you see is not necessarily true or real, that it's an illusion because of the type of education, we're all told to go to work, go get us a college education, work real hard, get a job, and we'll be successful. It takes an unusual person with an unusual attitude to be successful in the world today. It doesn't come free. You have to work for it. And if you're going to spend your lifetime or the next few years amassing some money, doesn't it make sense to ensure your success? Now, you can go out and buy traditional insurance and do some of the traditional type planning, or you can learn to play chess by your rules. I would rather play in my front yard with my ball. And if you don't like my rules, then I'm going to take my ball in the house and you can go home. And that's the nice thing about properly structuring your business is that you write the rules. And you can protect your lifetime's work by taking a little time now to set up your business properly and to listen to some coaching and some guidance and establish the thing the way it should be the first time. For some reason in life, there's always time to do things right the second time around. But it is much more prudent, efficient, and effective to do it right the first time out. So let me ask you a question. If you're going to put all this effort into establishing a business and that business becomes successful, are you willing to lose a lifetime's worth of work because you're too lazy to do the work on the front end? Now, I know that's hard talk, but you need to hear this. So my question is, if you're serious about protecting your future, then I am serious about helping. But if you're not concerned about it, and you're going to be like most people and turn over your stock portfolio to a broker to operate on an automatic pilot without any input or guidance from you because you want to go party instead of taking a couple hours a week and managing your money, then you deserve what you get. But if you want to have a successful investment experience, then you need to take control of your life and not farm it out. So yes, I'm going to ask you to do some hard work. But the other side of it is for your benefit. Anything worth having is worth working for. Life is like a garden. It's only successful if you work at it. And knowledge is not power. Knowledge applied with God's guidance is power. So my question, are you serious about starting the right way, or do we go our separate way? Well, let me tell you exactly how I got into this, Michael. First, my best buddy asked me if I would come in and go to work with him in the insurance business, and I said, no, thank you. I don't want to be the cancer to society. He said, but you don't understand. I do advanced type planning. So he and I got together and formed a company, and it grew very quickly. In a few months, we were recruiting agents and ended up being a brokerage firm that had over 500 contracted agents. 3 years from that, I gave him the opportunity to buy me out, which he graciously agreed to do. So then I had to go out and find something else to do. In the meantime, I had outgrown him basically in knowledge and decided to go to a class for certified estate planners. And I went there, and they exposed me to a few things, and then the connections that I had in that organization exposed me to doing planning offshore a couple weeks, a month, to the Bahamas and foreign jurisdictions, and learned how to actually do offshore planning. And then I came home and bought my knowledge to that because of an illness. I had to return home permanently, and I decided I would take that and apply it to the domestic front because many people are very afraid and unsure of the offshore jurisdictions, and deservedly so. So I decided to take that and apply it to the domestic arena, and that's basically how I got to the
business. What are the designations, and what do all these acronyms stand for?
I'm a member of the National Institute of Certified Estate Planners. That's about a year course. It can be done in 5 months, but I did take their master's course, which took about a year to complete, and then I became a certified senior advisor, which is basically a designation that is introduced by the Society of Certified Senior Advisors, which targets people in healthcare and the financial planning services industries to educate them on the needs and the planning for seniors. Then I became a certified charity advisor, where I work with charities individually, showing them how to set up a charitable giving department without administrative costs and without the responsibility of making monthly payments to people who purchase a charitable gift annuity from them. And I basically farmed that out to other entities and have them reinsured. I also became a registered financial consultant, which is synonymous to a certified financial planner, and basically they require you to have training and designations before they accept you, and the CEPs and CSAs and CCAs qualify for that. They want you to have a broad range of planning. And then during that time, I became involved with Medicaid planning, teaching clients how to preserve their assets if they did not have long-term care insurance and were unfortunately faced with going into a long-term care situation. And as a result of that, I began to educate myself. I was taught by one fella who really didn't spend a lot of time with me. And so I researched the law and got into contact and network with elder law attorneys and built a successful practice that I have now with a friend of mine who also does what I do, and he covers the basis for me when I'm sick or unable to be there. So I have a joint venture with him. And then I became certified entrepreneur advisor. And a certified entrepreneur advisor, I learned how to help entrepreneurs raise capital for their new ventures or a new venture within their current company without giving up any equity or ownership in their business, while at the same time being able to guarantee that the investor will receive an amount equal to his original investment in the company, whether the business succeeds or fails. And that is a very unique niche. And it's something that's very needed because most entrepreneurs are only taught how to go out and beg for money from angel investors or venture capitalists. And there are other ways to do it.
Enjoy everything, but own nothing. Control is better than ownership, and it goes against all of our training. Can you tell me, what does this mean to you?
Well, one of the biggest changes in my life was when I found out that I could control things without owning them. For example, if I wanted to purchase a home and the buyer had a situation where he didn't have a lot of interest in that piece of property and he really wanted to get something done with it, I might offer him an option to purchase the house for a few thousand down and maybe make payments for him to give me an option of a year. And then I go out and try to find a prospective buyer or someone who buys homes and fixes them up, because I don't like doing manual labor that well. And I may flip that note, that option to purchase, to that fixer-upper, and then let him make the remainder of the profit. My idea is to get in and out as quick as I can without having to own the ownership or do escrow closing.
Okay, but for the public out there, people who operate businesses, dentists, doctors, lawyers, is it a strategy that you would recommend to control everything but own nothing?
Yes, it would be. What I believe is that you don't have to own something to control it or enjoy it. For example, if I had an Olympic swimming pool and I said, Michael, I'm going to let you use this pool free of charge. I'm going to keep the pH up on it. I'm going to keep the fence up to keep the children out. I'm going to keep it clean. The pool man's going to come and do everything for it. You and your family can come use this pool anytime you wish at absolutely no charge. Isn't that better than the responsibility of ownership?
No, absolutely.
If I had a brand new Jaguar, and I said, Michael, you can come get this car. Here's the key. Drive it anytime you want to. I'm going to pay the insurance, keep it clean, have it waxed and detailed once a month, and you just use it as your own. Is that not better than owning it?
Yeah.
Okay, that's basically what you can do with your businesses and with your financial life, is you can have companies that take good care of you while you own nothing.
All right, well, let's get into that. Let's talk about some business structures. Why is the structure of the business that I have important?
Well, there's actually three or four main reasons why the structure is very important. First of all, the type of structure you have actually determines the amount of profit that you're going to have. And so if you have a structure that is more advantageous to you in the profit arena, of course, that's something you should consider over one that has detriments in that area. It also determines the type of liabilities that you could suffer. If you have the wrong business entity, you could end up losing everything that you've amassed from 20 years of hard work because of one innocent mistake or a tragic accident. It also determines the type of tax treatment that you're going to have. Of course, tax is important in businesses because tax, every dollar saved equals a dollar of profit. So if you're being overtaxed or double taxed because of your tax structure, you may want to consider another structure. And also, when it comes to employee benefits, underneath the new ERISA laws that came into effect about 15 years ago, you cannot discriminate against employees, so therefore you have to make a contribution to each employee's retirement program. But there are ways to separate programs out that benefit mainly you if you have the proper type of business structure to do that.
Okay, what business structures are available?
Well, there are many, but let's start off with the sole proprietor. It's probably the most easy one to set up. Basically, all it takes is a business license and a shingle and an idea and a little bit of operating capital. The problem with the sole proprietorship, there are many sole proprietorships that have operated for many years without any type of liability or litigation, but if there's ever a problem in that business, the owner is totally responsible and may end up with a judgment that he has to satisfy because he is the sole proprietor of that business.
Before we get into all this, all the structures are important. If I've got a business and I'm making a ton of money and there is an accident in my business or someone tries to sue me or there's some kind of liability, all that income that I've earned from my business is what I want to protect. I want to protect what I make. And the whole reason having the proper business structure is to protect all that hard work that I've put into the business in my personal assets. Is that correct?
Absolutely. I'm an asset protection proponent.
And this is really the whole idea of what you're going to teach me today.
That's right.
So sole proprietor, easiest thing to do, say I'm going to start a business recycling aluminum cans. All I've got to do is go down to the county courthouse. If I want checks written out to me in my business name, I'd get a fictitious business name statement. I would buy a license for probably under $100, and then I am in business.
Right. And if you're going to resell wholesale products for profit.
A resale license.
A license, right.
Okay, so all the checks that come to me come in my name or my fictitious business names, but that money earned is all mixed in with my home and my car and everything else.
That's correct, and that represents a huge liability. The thing is that you could set up would be a partnership. You have to find someone who has an idea and you decide you want to go into partnership with them. Maybe he's got the expertise in the sales department, but you've got the expertise in administration and management. And they're very easy to set up. It just takes a partnership agreement. That's generally established by an attorney, or you can get them off the web these days. But the problem with partnerships is that you're responsible entirely for your partner's actions. So if he commits a sexual abuse against an employee or has an accident, you can find yourself suffering the consequences just as if you had done that action yourself, even though you're completely innocent.
Is a partnership set up where your personal assets are in jeopardy?
Yes. Partnership is basically a organization of convenience, but the responsibility passes out to the partners individually.
That sounds like it's more risky than the sole proprietorship.
It is more risky because not only are you responsible for your own actions, you're responsible for your partner's actions.
Do you see a lot of partnerships out there?
I do see a lot of partnerships, and I generally try to suggest that each partner consider a buy-sell agreement that not only includes the death of a partner, but also the disability of a partner. Many people are willing to set up a buy-sell agreement in case there's a death so they don't find themselves in business with their ex-partner's wife or or worse yet, his new wife. That type of thing can be devastating to a business if the partner passes away. If that wife comes in and wants to control the business, she may be able to, depending upon what their partner's estate plan determined.
All right, so you're saying if, let's say I'm hard-headed and I'm not going to listen to your advice and I want a partnership, you're going to recommend, if I do maintain a partnership, to have a buy-sell agreement?
Absolutely. That includes not only death, but disability, so the money will be there to buy out that partnership, so you will have control of the business and not have to be interfered with by the family.
But that's all it really covers in case someone gets ill or there's a death.
That's true. But the other side of that is something that's very vital. And unfortunately, probably 90% of partnerships fail within the first 10 years.
Why do you think that is?
I think it's because one partner ends up unknowingly or not intentionally giving the other partner more work to do by not contributing as much as the other partner. Or he may actually be contributing as much, but for some reason the other partner feels like he's not contributing as much as he is. And they feel like that the money is being split equally, but the work is one-sided. So
bad feelings start.
Absolutely.
Very difficult. It's like joint ventures. Partnerships, just based on my experience, they're very difficult. They start off great with good intentions, and there's a lot of things you need to do. You really need to communicate before you start one of exactly what each person's responsibilities are going to be and be realistic about it.
Yeah, two women were fighting over the baby, and the king said, well, I got an idea. I'll just cut him in half. And sometimes that's what you have to do. You just have to cut the business in half and go your separate ways. The other type of business that is probably the first thing out of an attorney's mouth, if you say, I want to start a business, what form of business do I need? He's going to say that you need a corporation.
Why is he going to say that?
Because it's most profitable to him, and he has continuing fees that he can make off of the annual reviews of the corporation that's doing the minutes and bylaws updates each year.
What's a corporation?
A corporation is basically an entity that's established that has presidents and treasurers and officers of that nature, and it also issues closely held stock or common stock to raise the capital to start the corporation. For example, if I wanted to start a corporation and I didn't have all of the money that I needed to start that corporation, I might solicit other people to contribute funds in exchange for stocks in my new business venture. The corporations have a very unsavory situation in them that many people don't consider. When the profits come into a corporation, they are generally taxed at the corporate level, and then when they're passed out to the stockholders have to again pay income tax on the receipts for their share of the corporations. And it's double taxation. So then you get into the catch-22 is, do I retain the profits in the corporation this year to take advantage of a lower corporate tax that may be in place in that particular year or that particular administration's term of office? Or do I pass it out to myself and pay a higher tax? And in years where the individual tax is lower and the corporation tax is higher, of course, you want to pass that money out to you as an individual to pay a lower tax on that amount. But then the IRS steps in and says, wait a minute, you're being overcompensated, so we're going to claim this as corporate profits. And if you retain it as corporate profits, they're going to say you're retaining too much income. You need to pass it out to the higher income tax bracket of your stockholders. So it's a continuous battle, and I just don't see any need for it. Other than the fact that corporations do offer asset protection, but the veil of the corporation asset protection has been penetrated so many times by aggressive attorneys, they know that they may not be able to get to the assets of the corporation, so they just turn around and decide to go after the individual officers of that corporation, and oftentimes they win.
So the ideal benefit of a corporation is to protect your personal assets, but what you're saying over the years, an aggressive attorney can eliminate that protection by going after the stockholders personally, and they've succeeded.
Absolutely.
You've seen cases of this happen over and over?
I've seen it happen over and over.
So this idea of a corporation really protecting your personal assets, is it a facade?
It can be a facade, but the nice thing is if the corporation is being used as a pawn in their game, and I'll get into that a little later, but basically if a corporation owns nothing but a pad of paper and a pen, they can sue it all day long. What are they going
to
get?
But can they go to the principal of the corporation even that way?
Yes, they can, but if the principal of the corporations own nothing but enjoy everything, what are they going to target?
So your strategy is an idea back to this control everything but own nothing, and we can do this through the system that you've got in place.
Yes.
All right, let's go to S-corporation election. How does this differ?
That's a good thing, Michael, because that's the next thing the attorneys offer. They basically say, take your corporation and file an S-election. And basically what they're saying is that all of the expenditures and profits of the corporation will be passed out to basically the president's 1040, and therefore he would have a Schedule C attached and can make deductions for his business and incorporate his personal deductions at the same time.
All right, you got to do that in English for me.
It is easier to file a tax return if you take an S-Corp election. It's just a tax election. It basically says I'm going to be able to take the profits and the losses and the expenses of the corporation and apply them to my personal 1040.
My personal tax return.
That's right. And it just makes it unnecessary to do two tax filings and just makes life a little easier. However, when an attorney sees that and he is investigating the possibility of suing you, he's going to look at you as a target because he's going to say, ah, this is a facade. Actually, what's happening here is that you are the owner of this business. Therefore, the president is actually a target again. Get people to quit painting bullseyes on their chest.
So your S corporation is just as liable, even more so, the way it's set up than the corporation if someone wants to come after you.
Right, because the president inherits the liabilities, and the liabilities are greater than they are in a C corporation.
Okay, let's go to limited partnership. What's this all about?
You're pretty knowledgeable. Limited partnerships are basically an entity that runs similar to a trust. If you imagine a box, and that box represents the limited partnership, there are two types of partners. The first is a general partner. The general partner has total control of the limited partnership. He makes all the final decisions. He runs the business. He purchases items, hires and fires, and does basically what an owner of a sole proprietor would do, but he is a general partner of a partnership.
All right, I love examples. So let's say you and I are starting this business selling boxes, and I'm the general partner. I'm the guy who's going to operate and run the entire business.
And that's what most people do. One person's a general partner, and then he goes out and solicits other people to join him in partnership through contributions to the partnership, and they receive in exchange for their contribution limited partnership.
When we say contribution, you mean money.
Investment in the company.
All right, so let's say you invest $20,000 in this business that sells boxes. You're the limited partner, but you don't have the control of the business?
Right. You have to decide what each one of those limited memberships is worth or what each general membership is worth. And it's generally predicated upon what you invest in the business. For example, if we decided that we were going to have 100 units and we were going to try to raise $100,000, then each unit would be worth $1,000. So if the general partner has 20 units, then he's going to receive 20% of the profits that are pro rata in ratio to those units.
Can I still be a general partner and have a low amount of units? Does the units and being a general partner coincide, or is it independent?
It can be independent, but unfortunately that's attracted the attention of the IRS many times. So it's better to just keep things on an even keel.
So in our box company, what would you recommend me as a general partner? How many units should I have?
I think you should have 20 units. Now, the other 80 units could be divided among other investors who are limited members. So at the end of the year, after all deductions and expenses, any profits that are left out are passed out because a limited partnership is a pass-through entity, meaning that all the tax liabilities or losses pass out to the individual members according to their share of the membership.
Sorry, if someone has more units than me, does that throw my general partnership status off?
It doesn't, because they're not voting units. You own all the voting units. However, many attorneys and business structure specialists do not know this, but it's something that you should consider. You may want to be a 1% member who is the only general partner, and then you also control the other 19% as a limited member. So you could be both a general partner and a limited partner at the same time, thereby reduce your liability. So most of the time, limited partners are only responsible for their portion. Now, there's a lot of good case law behind limited partnerships. They've been tested in court. They've been challenged by the IRS and by litigants and creditors, and they have held up very well.
Use my box example. I'm the general partner. We've got this company that sells boxes. I have 20 units, okay? I've got 80 additional units. Let's say I get 80 other limited partners at $1,000 a unit, and that makes up my limited partnership. I'm the general, and there's 80 others.
Four other partners with 20 shares like you have.
All right, let's say four other partners with 20 shares.
Not shares, but memberships, yes.
And what are the pros of this box business that we have with limited partners?
Well, the pros are very good because it really reduces the the possibility of getting a judgment against the partner.
Okay, so give me an example. Our box company, we send out some boxes and they cut someone and someone wants to sue our limited partnership. How is that going to work and how is it going to protect me?
I'm the type of person that likes to be equitable as well as ethical. And if it's just a cut and we're looking at a $4,000 or $5,000 claim, of course, the company is going to carry insurance for that and that's going to be handled. But what really concerns me is when we got frivolous lawsuits in excess of $1 million. And then what you're going to find out is that what's going to happen is it goes to court and the plaintiff wins a judgment. It doesn't necessarily mean...
Are they suing me, the general, and all the limited?
Generally, what they're doing is suing the partnership itself.
They don't list all the limited partners in there?
Most of the time, they do not. They can, but most of the time do not. But they do try to go after general partner because he has control.
All right, so what you're going to see in the lawsuit, the limited partnership, the name is going to be sued as a whole and sometimes the general partner.
Absolutely. Most of the time, they don't prevail because the judge basically said, well, this is why a limited partnership is set up, is to relieve some of the liability. But it has happened many times. That's why I really decided to use another entity in probably 90% of the cases that I handle. But the other point is, many times, a plaintiff only ends up with a charging order where he's being treated as a limited partner. And he will receive his pro rata share of any distributions from the company. The trick is to make sure that there are no distributions. And we'll talk about that.
All right. Well, you got to bring me back to my example because I can learn best from example. We got a frivolous lawsuit. They're going to sue our box partnership. So there's a lawsuit. Who is liable?
Generally, who is liable is a partnership as a whole, unless they come after the general partner, too. And often they do. And then the general partner may be responsible for that lawsuit according to the percentage of the company that he owns. But that does not preclude the fact that an aggressive attorney may come after his personal holdings.
So where are the pros of a limited partnership, or where are attorneys telling people the pros of a limited partnership are?
Basically, they're advising people to go into limited partnerships because of the asset protections, because it's rather new. It's only been around about 50 years. And most people are unsuccessful when they go after a limited partnership.
Why are they unsuccessful?
Basically because judges understand that there are many frivolous lawsuits and they rule against it.
Because it's frivolous or because there's some added protection in the way this limited partnership is set up?
Both.
Okay, so there are some things when you're set up as a limited partnership that do protect you maybe a little bit more than a corporation or a sole proprietor?
Right.
What I want to know is, in this limited partnership, where does the structure offer the benefit for the person who has a limited partnership?
It offers a benefit because, first of all, they don't have to front all the money. They can go looking for investor partners. Why investors would be attracted to a limited partnership is because they have limited liability. Because if they're a limited member, they do not suffer any of the consequences of a lawsuit.
I see. So the limited members are totally safe. So the only one liable is the general partner, really.
Right. The only time I've ever seen a limited member get into trouble is when he was the one who actually caused the liability.
So the advantage is a limited partnership has an advantage. If you want to start a business and raise capital, you can do it without all the stocks and the corporation stuff.
Absolutely.
Easier, quicker, less expensive, right?
Yes, and it's a lot easier to put together a deal.
And these have been around for about 50 years?
Yep, been around a good while.
And they're pretty solid?
They're pretty solid. The newest entity on the market is a limited liability company. And basically what a limited liability company is, it's a hybrid. It's actually a combination of a corporation and a limited partnership. So you have two types of members.
How new is this?
This has been around in our state for about 15 years and several other states, California, for example, for about 25 years. There's not as much case law on these type of entities, but they have been tested quite a bit here recently and has held up extremely well.
So the pros of this hybrid?
The pros are that it's very hard to attack your general partner. Like the limited partnership, it's almost impossible to get a judgment against the general partner because he holds that position, although it can be done if that general partner is the one who caused the action.
Why is it hard to attack? Because of the way it's set up?
Basically because the limited liability company says that the partners are not liable for the actions of the company.
Kind of like a corporation.
Yeah. And the cons are very few. There are many benefits to having a limited liability company. First of all, they're very easy to set up. All you have to do is file for an articles of organization from your state. In North Carolina, the fee is $125, and then every year there's what's called a franchise fee, but in North Carolina they call it an annual report. You get to fill out your annual report and pay them $200 for the process. Other states are much cheaper on their annual renewal. So you need to look around and see which state is beneficial to you. However, if you have a foreign corporation, and I'm not talking about offshore, a foreign limited liability company would be a limited liability company that's actually domiciled in another state but is doing business in your residence.
And you can do that?
Yeah, you can do that, but then you have to pay the additional franchise fee for that entity to operate within that particular state. I have a way around that is very unique and may work better for some of your students. The liabilities are basically this. If someone were to win a judgment against a limited liability company, basically all they're going to receive is a charging order from the judge that basically says you are now a quasi-limited member and you are to get your share of any distributions that come out of the limited liability company.
So the person suing the limited liability company, their judgment isn't like a judgment for $1 million. The judgment is you become one of the limited partners.
Right, a quasi-limited partner.
But why don't they get the judgment for all the money?
Because many times the money is not there. And also, they're only going to win the judgment wherein the judge says you're a limited member now and you get to get your share of the judgment. So that's basically the only thing they can get they'll be successful in is a charging order.
And when you say charging order, we're talking about the judgment.
Right. The judgment's a charging order that basically says you're going to be treated as a limited member until your judgment is satisfied.
Well, let's say I'm the person who sued our box company, and the box company was a limited liability company, and the judge said, okay, I'm going to give you a charging order for $10,000 to cover your medical expenses and what have you. Now, what if your limited liability company did have those assets in the business? Would I get a judgment for $10,000?
It could, but if I were the astute manager of that limited liability company, what I might do is say, limited members and general members, we're having a cash flow crunch this year. And so what we need to do is retain all operating capital. But because we file a 1065 and you receive K-1 distributions every year, what I need to do is send you out a tax done for money that you didn't receive. So the limited members are going to receive, let's say in this case, a done for $10,000. So that charging order or successful judgment holder is going to receive basically a tax bill saying that he's earned $10,000 and he's going to have to pay taxes on that even though he hasn't received any real money. How long do you think he's going to hold on to that hot potato?
Okay, and this is a strategy that is totally legal and ethical that can be done in a limited liability company.
Absolutely, it works like a charm.
How about a limited partnership?
A limited partnership can do the same things, but it's not as clean as it is in a limited liability company. And another thing that could happen is that the limited liability company could make huge investments in company assets and make sure there's no profits. It also could set up a leasing company and then turn around and lease all of its equipment from the new limited liability company, and there would be no profits for many years to come.
Setting up these entities is kind of like offense and defense in a football game.
Absolutely. It goes back to my favorite motto, control everything, enjoy everything, but own nothing.
This is the end of part one. Please continue to part two. Did you know I do audio interviews? I bet you could tell by now that I do audio interviews with experts on marketing, advertising, direct mail, list management, you name it. My interviews can build the value of your information products. My interviews can enhance the sales of a website. My interviews can make you famous. If you want someone who has an intimate knowledge of the direct mail business and understands the questions to ask, understands how to dig out the scoop, understands how to produce, develop, and create a compelling audio product, you want to talk to me. I promise you, if you've got a product you're selling and you want to bring life and build value into it, please contact me.